More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. It took 10 years for Wisconsin writer Susannah Daniels' first novel to go from inception to bookstores. Stiltsville told the story of a long and generally happy marriage and its sad ending. Her new novel is different in a couple of key ways. The marriage at its heart isn't so happy, and it found its way to print much more quickly. But there is one key similarity. Sea Creatures returns us to South Florida and the community of offshore houses called Stiltsville. It tells the story of the unraveling of the marriage between Georgia and Graham, along with Graham's struggles with parasomnia and their son's seeming inability to talk. Susannah Daniel made the drive over from Madison ahead of her appearance tomorrow night in Milwaukee. Welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thanks so much for having me, Mitch.
You return us to Miami in this book. That is where Stiltsville was set, and in part you even take us back to Stiltsville. Did you feel, was there some unfinished writerly business with South Florida that you felt you had as you got going with this?
There definitely was, and I really fought it for a long time. I wrote hundreds of pages of a book that did not take place at Stiltsville, and then one day I was telling my husband, I really just want to write about Stiltsville again, and I feel like I can't. Like there's some rule that I can't in, you know, creative writing world. And he said, well, that's just kind of stupid. And I said, oh, you know, it is stupid. I think I'm going to do that again. So I scrapped what I had and I started writing again. And Stiltsville had taken years and years and years to write. Once I really got going on this second book, it took 10 months. It was a straight shot. It felt really good to be back.
Well, and if I understand correctly, the hermit Charlie in this book was inspired by a real live hermit who once lived in Stiltsville?
That's right. When I was growing up, we went to Stiltsville on the weekends. My grandfather built a house, and my parents used to stand at the kitchen window with binoculars and spy on this guy. And I thought that was normal. I now realize that it's not. And we don't spy on our neighbors, just so everyone knows.
But, in case they're listening.
Right. And he was pretty much always nude, and he had no boat. People would come out in boats and party with him. He was just basically this like hippie guy. And I never was all that interested in him as a kid. But once the stilt houses were erased by Hurricane Andrew, I did end up thinking, well, where'd that guy go? This was his house. You know, we just went back to land. And that's the question that I kind of wanted to answer with this book.
What inspired you to write about the two significant maladies affecting characters in this book? There's parasomnia and there's selective mutism.
You know, writers always say, like, write what you can't get out of your head. I think that's very good advice. And a lot of times I think as writers make the mistake of sort of latching onto something strange or interesting and not having, like, a personal connection to it. And you can really feel when that's missing. I am an insomniac. I've been an insomniac since I was in my early 20s. And it's interesting only in a, kind of a minor way in my life. But a few years ago, I was in the parking lot with my sleeping son in the back seat. And, you know, as you do, you stay where you are when your child is asleep in the back seat. And I turned on the Moth Radio Hour. And Mike Birbiglia, comedian, was, I think this was the first time Sleepwalk With Me was ever aired. It was way before he was on This American Life with it, way before he did the movie. But it was this hilarious monologue about a parasomniac who actually ends up like going through a plate glass window out of a hotel room and like running, bleeding across the across the lawn because he thinks he's being chased by jackals or something like that. And then he has to go back in to the hotel and say, like, I was, you know, I went through a plate glass window and you need to call the ambulance. And it's hilarious. And I was like laughing. But I was also thinking about the ways in which my husband and I cope with my insomnia in that small way that it impacts our lives. And then what would it be like to be married to somebody with severe parasomnia? And of course, I didn't write a funny book. I wrote a book that really, really, really asks that question. And the other thing is that my first son didn't start to talk for a long time. And I was a new mother and I was nervous. And I had the incredible people at Wisconsin Birth to Three into the house to evaluate him. And he's verbose now. Sometimes I wish he were a little less so. But I did ask myself for a long time, well, how are we going to cope with this? What are they going to be the strategies? And in my book, Georgia has a 3.5-year-old who doesn't speak. And a lot of the book is dedicated to sort of the strategies that she has come up with to cope with that.
Actually, I want to go back to insomnia. for a minute, and you talk about the different kinds of strategies that you and your husband have for dealing with your insomnia, which is, I'm guessing, at a significantly different level than Graham, the parasomniac in this.
It's very minor compared to that. But you can tell, I think that anyone who has any kind of minor illness wonders, what will it be like if that illness just takes a turn? And I actually could see that happening as an insomniac. I could see it becoming much worse over the course of my lifetime. And it scares me. And I think probably most insomniacs feel the same way.
Does it facilitate writing in a different way? I mean, as you think about your circadian rhythms, if you will, does creativity hit you in a different time frame than it does for someone who's on the typical waking, sleeping clock?
No. I have often wished that I could be creative in the middle of the night because I get so many more hours. But usually I spend them watching television. Because I'm not fully awake and I'm not motivated and I'm a little angry the whole time.
The marriage that was at the heart of your first novel was a generally happy one, mm-hmm. And a strong one, with forces kind of tugging at it. That is not the case in Sea Creatures with Georgia and Graham. Was it difficult for you to write about a marriage in chaos?
It was difficult. Like, marriage is infinitely interesting to me, and I think that for the most part in real life, not in fictional life, we don't know what's going on in other people's marriages. They're very private and very personal, which seems obvious, but yet we all talk about marriage as if we know what's going on with other people. So what I really, really wanted to show was a sympathetic side, a very dark moment in a marriage where nobody is the bad guy.
Right. Georgia is not a flawless character who is dealing with a husband who is entirely flawed. They are both flawed and they are both not to blame.
Right. There's something that I really wanted to explore in Sea Creatures, which is that sometimes when two people have a child, there ends up being a kind of love triangle that happens. And there's a lot of parental ambivalence out there, and I wanted to show it in a humane way.
Who is the hardest character in this book to wrap your head around?
Probably Graham, because I think it's difficult to sympathize with anyone who doesn't just slobberingly love children. I personally sympathize with them, even as a mother, but I think most people tend to vilify people who don't want to be parents.
There's a significant historical event that undergirds part of this novel, which I won't give away, but that happened in Stiltsville as well.
Well, it's 1992 in Miami, so you pretty much know what's going to happen.
All right, so Hurricane Andrew undergirds a major scene in this book. And that happened in Stiltsville as well, the novel Stiltsville with the murders in Gainesville, actually. Why do you like setting these stories in the mid-range past among real, true events?
That's a good question. I'm drawn to that phase of history in Miami because it was a time when South Florida was going in a lot of different directions and nobody was quite sure what was going to happen. But also, to me, it's very personal. You know, I remember being afraid when the Gainesville murders happened, and I remember Hurricane Andrew. I remember looking out and watching Hurricane Andrew descend on my house. So to me, that is the most autobiographical part of both of my novels, the setting.
And it's worth pointing out, I think, that it doesn't feel like a historical novel in most conventional senses of the term. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, I had to remind myself why Georgia was going to get film developed.
She doesn't have a cell phone.
Right, exactly. I was going to mention that because there are points, why can't Graham get a hold of her? Where's her cell phone? And I had to remind myself this was 1992.
Well, Ann Patchett says that you can't have cell phones in fiction. They sort of ruin all dramatic device. So she keeps having her characters lose them.
I wanted to ask you a question about the cover of this book. I know authors don't necessarily direct the art on the cover, but there is a pretty major change between the cover of The Galley Proof and what ended up in bookstores. There was an octopus, maybe inspired by one of Charlie the Hermit is a hermit painter, and maybe it was inspired by one of his paintings on the original cover. It is gone, along with the waves on the finished cover. What were your feelings on how the cover ought to look?
I loved the first cover, but I was wrong. The second cover is better. There was a question of whether or not the cover should imply the sea creatures or show them. And it came down to wanting to leave them unshown. And I think that's right. It's a very serious cover. And the book is a pretty intense read. So I think it matches pretty well.
And the sea creatures, I mean, that's one of the things that Charlie paints, but there are some not so literal sea creatures that inhabit this book.
Right. And he actually doesn't paint, he draws. He draws very intricate, like almost medically precise drawings of sea creatures. And he becomes a kind of father figure to Frankie very quickly. He has this focus on Frankie that Frankie's own father lacks. Right. And he starts to give Frankie these little toys, these sea creature toys, from the beginning. And by the end of the book, which is just takes place over the course of a summer, Frankie has amassed like a whole army of these little guys, which my son also did exuberantly.
And all the while that this book was coming to pass, well, first of all, you were having another child yourself, mm-hmm. Which I imagine made some of the questions that you were writing about more murky? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, was it hard to weigh these questions as real live events were happening to you?
Pregnancy has always given me a lot of focus. So it was a great time for me to write. I really put my head down and finished. I sold the book 2 weeks before I gave birth to my second son. But the other thing that in my own life, pregnancy has always been difficult to come by. And then also the decision to have a second child was a very big one in my marriage and in my life. And that's something that Georgia has on the page as well, her decision to only have one, and then some ambivalence about that decision. Charlie, who has had, you know, personal devastation in his past, weighs in on that as well. I think the decision to have one child is a really great, beautiful decision that is for some reason not given the respect that it deserves. And one day, maybe I'd like to write a book more about that.
When did the decision to start a writing studio come in?
I have a great novel group in Madison of female novelists, all of whom have one or more books, one of whom has eight. And a good friend of mine who has young kids and doesn't have a teaching job, Michelle Wilgen, her third book comes out in February. I said to her, you know what, this is what we're going to do. Because I looked around, I looked at Sackett Street Writers in Brooklyn, which has been around for 10 years, and it's an amazing program. I looked at The Loft in Minneapolis, Grub Street Writers in Boston, and I said, why doesn't Madison have this? Every time I visit a book club, somebody comes up to me and says, you know, I want to write a book. And I think I could be a writer. And I say, well, I think you could too. But you know what I needed? I needed a class. I needed to sit down. I needed face-to-face instruction around a table where I got feedback from somebody who knew what they were doing. And Michelle and I do know what we're doing at this point. And I thought, well, you know, Madison has a university, a great creative writing program, but that's a completely different thing from what we're doing. And then they also have one-day and weekend workshops, which is a completely different thing. You know, I think that there are a lot of people who want to learn to write in sort of a sustained manner, who want to do it in the evenings, working around their schedules, adults mostly, and basically around a dining room table where they can feel comfortable putting their work out there and forming a community.
Do you feel like you learned something about your own work from teaching it to other people?
Oh, yes, I do. And I get a lot of writing vigor from teaching, almost too much probably. And then I go and I just vomit it out all over the computer screen and it turns out bad. But no, I love it. I think that teaching writing is not necessary for all people, but that for some people it's a really great way of kind of getting their head around the discipline and the skill that goes along with the talent that they were born with.
Become a writer? Is there some innate thing that you have to get, or can you really start from the ground floor?
I think you can start from the ground floor. I think we all have tics, and that a person diligently writing day after day can learn to rein in his or her own tics, but that we can get there a lot faster if we give them feedback.
Susannah Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Susannah Daniel's latest novel is Sea Creatures, published by HarperCollins. She lives in Madison, but she'll be at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee tomorrow evening to read from her book. If you just can't wait, you can hear her read two excerpts from it at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. You'll also find a link to more about the Madison Writers Studio as well.